circle. Interested in joining this select group? Please consider a donation of $1,000 or more online at wpfwfm.org. Your donation helps WPFW build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Yo, peace, this is Rod Stars.
Peace, this is G1, and together we're Rebel D.I.s. When we in the DMV, you know we listening to that People Power Radio, WPFW Washington, your station for jazz and justice. Let's go.
This is a journey.
I got so much trouble on my mind. Refuse to lose. Here's your ticket.
He is amazing.
I didn't know nothing about it.
I don't want to be like Mike.
Say what you say, say what?
I don't want to be like Mike.
Before Magic's knees go permanently south for the winter.
I don't want to be like Mike.
Changing up the guard quicker than fear brings down doo-doo.
Put the finger roll! Plus the foul!
Hey, young bro.
He never saw Elgin Baylor play during his day, or Oscar Robinson.
Flash the dice roll back. The big O was jackknifing through all them bodies.
I didn't know nothing about it.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Collision. It's an hour like no other on terrestrial radio, whether you're talking about DC, the DMV, or these United States. This is where sports and politics collide. I'm Dave Zirin, joined as always by Mr. Chuck Modiano. Chuck, how you doing, sir?
I'm doing great, DZ. How about yourself?
Well, I'm thrilled to be here because it's WPFW 89.3 FM, and we are trying to change this world one broadcast at a time. And our normal cohort, the trifecta, the troika on our three musketeers of sports and politics, former NBA great Etan Thomas, I do believe will be joining us at the bottom of the hour. So I'm very excited about that as well. He is pretzeling his schedule because there are things that he wants to discuss, and our listeners are the people he wants to hear what he has to say. So that's good news, is it not, sir?
It is great news, and I love the word troika. I like that. I think we should roll with that.
Well, thank you. I'm trying to work with some of these things. I'm expanding my vocabulary at the moment.
I love your vocabulary. It's very colorful.
Oh, grazie, grazie. That's Italian for let's keep the show moving.
I might be too encouraging right now, but go ahead.
Yeah. We got so much to discuss this week at this intersection of sports and politics. So much going on in the world, of course. And like I said, we got Etan Thomas at the bottom of the hour. I know he wants to talk to us about what last night was a classic revenge game. Actually, it was even deeper than a revenge game. It was like, frankly, nothing I've ever seen on an NBA court. Luka Doncic coming back with the Lakers into Dallas to just rapturous applause and tears and chance to fire the GM and so much. And then Luka comes out and drops 45 points amidst all that emotion, 30 in the first half. Etan wants to talk about that at the bottom of the hour. We surely will. We also want to talk about these NCAA championships, particularly Houston, when they get to the finals and Akeem Olajuwon stopped from coming on the court. Like, how you how you profile the 7 foot man who's the legend of Houston and just be like, sir, you can't come on here. I don't know, man. We got to talk about that. We got to talk about the women's finals. Paige Beckers finally crossing that finish line, winning UConn their first title in 10 years. Or was it 9 years? Either way, that's a long time for UConn.
That's like 50 years for another university.
Exactly. That's like the Mets. And, you know, we do want to talk about a lot of what's going on in the Dominican Republic right now, this nightclub roof collapse and how it's affecting members of Major League Baseball. And with that, I also would like to talk about here's a trivia question for you, Chuck. The country that produces the most Major League Baseball players is, of course, the United States. Number two, it won't shock you to know, is the Dominican Republic. What's three?
Venezuela.
It is Venezuela, and it is not even close. Now, given the hyper demonization of Venezuelans in this country right now, whether you were born in the United States or not, whether your citizenship is up to date or not, however you're viewed by ICE or not, the crackdown on people, if you happen to have that word Venezuela on your papers, on your passport, in your record, is absurd. And I would like to talk about how that's affecting this culture in Major League Baseball, where there are Venezuelan players in every locker room. Like, we need to talk about that.
We do.
There's actually a very interesting history about Venezuela and baseball and when Hugo Chavez was in charge and the incredible tension that created with Major League Baseball because he insisted on more funding for their baseball academies. A whole history there, man, that I think actually is connected to what we're dealing with right now and why some countries become scapegoats and some countries get brutalized by U.S. empire, particularly this very, very crude and cruel variant of U.S. empire that we're seeing right now from this hideous administration. But first, before we talk about any of this, people who listen to this show know that while we do bring the sports and we're happy to bring the sports, we also want to talk about like the street definition of politics. And this past weekend saw some massive marches in this country against the Trump administration. The demonstrations had different flavors in different areas. There were demonstrations in Trump country. These demonstrations coincide with a poll that came out. Did you see the Trump approval rating poll, Chuck, based upon age?
Tell us.
Did you see it, buddy? I just got to ask.
I know. I didn't see it, so this is great.
This is amazing.
The listeners and myself are at the edges of our seat.
All right, and then we'll get into these demos. Just check this out, Chuck, and then I'll throw it to you to connect it immediately with what you saw this past weekend in terms of the demonstrations. All right, so the first number is when Trump was inaugurated, and the second number is what Trump's popularity is now in terms of these cohorts. So 65 and older. At the inauguration, Trump was -4. Now he's -8. 45 to 64, Gen X, who I have quite the bone to pick with, they were at the time of, this is just so embarrassing, at the time of Trump's inauguration, they were +12 for this guy. And now they're +1. Okay, embarrassing to be +1, but down 11 points. 30 to 44, you were -6 when Trump was sworn in, -14 now. Now, here's the one where I want you to hold on to your socks.
Holding on to my socks.
Thank you. 18 to 29-year-olds. And I'm glad I didn't see this first number when Trump was inaugurated because I might have crawled under my bed and not come out. But at the time of Trump's inauguration, 18 to 29-year-olds were +5 for Trump. Now, they are -29.
That includes some Trumpers in there.
Oh, it has to, just by pure statistical. And you know what it also speaks to? It speaks to what happens when you're a Democratic Party that can't campaign on college campuses before an election because you're too scared of people raising the fact that you're funding a genocide. So you stay away from college campuses for an entire election season, unheard of in Democratic Party circles. And gee, look what happens. You lose the youth vote, but you lose the youth vote. But then the youth see what this dude is doing. And it goes from +5 to -29. That's almost like a generational roar that you are robbing us of our future. And I just think that's incredible. To go down 34 points in a couple of months with 18 to 29-year-olds is, to me, that should be like the front pages of every paper. But I digress. Big demonstrations over the weekend. Chuck, those numbers I just gave you, did you see that reflect itself in what you saw in the streets? Also, what demonstrations did you go to? I went to a couple in different cities. It's too confusing to describe, but I will tell you what I saw. But I'll throw it to you, Chuck. Demonstration Saturday. What did you see?
Well, I spent most of my time at the March for Gaza demonstration. And, you know, it was invigorating. And I have to say, Gaza demonstrations have continued nonstop since Trump has been elected, because there were some concerns or myths that they would not continue from very uninformed people. And they've been going nonstop. So two Wednesdays ago, there were marches in 36 cities and abroad and in international marches in London and Paris. And people didn't know about it because not on your TV. So this march, there were two. There was the Hands Off March and the March for Gaza. It was incredible and it was moving. And people came out to say, we're not backing away. We are not backing away. We are not afraid of you, Trump. You cannot abduct Mahmoud Khalil. You cannot abduct Georgetown's Badr Tansuri. You cannot abduct Rumeysa Ozturk. You cannot abduct anybody. And a common line you hear is come for one, face us all. We're coming back. We're not going to deal with this. You saw an incredible moving tribute of thousands of shoes going all the way down Pennsylvania Avenue to represent the 17,400 children who have been murdered by Israel. And that is a low figure. It's most likely double. Those are the only verified names. You saw journalists from Shireen Abu Akla, murdered a few years ago, to recent journalists who were murdered, get their due and let everybody know that over 200 journalists have been killed. And we've seen these huge signs being paraded down the street, signs of banners of journalists being paraded down the street and saying, no, you don't get to do that. You have killed more journalists than World War II and Vietnam. And it was educational, it was inspiring, and most importantly, and there was messages to the other marches that if you're going to stand against Trump's fascism, you need to stand against Trump's fascism all the way. So to close out, if I would say, I didn't attend the Hands Off March too much, maybe I peeked a little, so I can't speak too much about it, but there was a difference. You know, you're more likely at the Hands Off March, and people are starving at that march, and I wish they more moved on to the March for Gaza. Someone might say, you know what? That's incredible. Wow, Cori Bush spoke for 25 straight hours against Trump's fascism. You might hear that about that march. But at the March for Gaza march, you'll hear, wow, that's incredible. Cory Booker spoke for 25 straight hours about Trump's fascism and didn't mention Gaza even one time. That's incredible. So there's some differences there. And I'm hoping those who may be the first march start to move over and make their fight against Trump's fascism more consistent, more morally inclusive, and more morally and ethically consistent.
Very well put. I mean, what I saw Saturday was so important. I would never dismiss it. It's so important to make dissent visible. It's the number one way that you actually fight fascism is through noncompliance and through visible dissent. The more of it there is, the more difficult it is for them to push forward. And the amount of, as we have discussed often, voluntary compliance that we've seen from some very powerful forces, whether we're talking about media, university, you know, and we've also talked about complicity versus compliance. But either way, what happens is the same, the normalization of fascism and their advance on our rights and civil liberties. Now, what I saw at the Hands Off March was an incredible display of raw and unorganized anger. Now, this is the way I want to judge this march, not only by the size of it, which was, I don't even know if they did account for the DC Hands Off March. I heard the Palestine one, 8,000. Does that sound right, Chuck?
I suspect that that's what, there were definitely thousands. I'm not good when I'm right on the ground.
Me neither.
But so I'm just going to roll with whatever you're saying.
Yeah, and certainly bigger, the hands-off one. I mean, was massive, tens of thousands, not sure. Yeah. The thing about it that I found both encouraging and also illuminating, and when I say illuminating, I don't necessarily mean that positively, but what I found encouraging was that it seemed like almost everybody I saw had a handmade sign. Now, you and I are veterans of protests. Yes. We know that when you see a handmade sign, it means that somebody woke up that morning or stayed up the night before and took the time to really craft the message that they wanted to send to the world.
Yes.
And it shows an extra level of commitment. It shows an extra level of anger. It shows an extra level of even desperation. Because you feel like, why isn't anybody saying that this guy is a felon? Why isn't anybody saying that all of this stuff is just so blatantly against the law and yet somehow we're just accepting it? You know, why isn't anybody saying, you know, about the names of the disappeared? And there were many, many signs that had the names of people like Mahmoud Khalil or Rumesa or Abrejo Garcia. I mean,
that makes me feel good.
Yeah, there are a lot of those signs handmade. That being said, the handmade sign is also a double-edged sword. Because when you don't have massive printed signs, that also means it's being largely, it's diffuse. It's not an organized event. And it means that there is no guiding message. I mean, hands off is not really a message. There is no guiding message. There is no organizational heft on the ground. There is no money behind it that's willing to push forward for the next demonstration. And so that's one of those things where I'm like, good, handmade signs. That means these people out here really care. And then you're also like, well, okay, well, you know, it would also be good if it was just like, this is the message. And like, if everybody had a sign with Mahmoud Khalil's name on it that was printed up on Union, you know, printer and you know, things like that. Like, that has a different vibe. The other part of it that cannot be said loudly enough, and I feel like we're not taking a step back in saying it, is that not only was it so derelict that there was no, other than people wearing keffiyehs, I did not see any mention of Gaza at this march. Yes. Other than, the names of the disappeared, that's not a small thing because we know it's connected. But as far as like the word Gaza, with words of people, not people kidnapped in the United States, abducted in the United States, but the names of people who've been killed in Gaza, in the West Bank. I mean, I know this was after the march, so I'm not giving people guff for this, but a 14-year-old Palestinian American was just killed in the West Bank.
Yeah.
You know, like, and I hate to say this, but I'm not sure that her name would have been represented at the march.
Right.
You know, because it happened in Gaza, because you would not have known Gaza existed. Now, and the speakers, you know, believe me, like, I did not hear all the speakers. I don't want to pretend I did, but I mean, come on, like you might as well tell me the moon is made of blue cheese if you think that a speaker like my congressional representative, Jamie Raskin, who, of course, you know, we respect for all sorts of reasons, but he wasn't up there talking about Gaza. Come on now.
Right. No, he wasn't.
And other Dems who did speak there were not up there talking about Gaza. So, maybe a speaker did or not, I can't say for sure, but it was, other than the wearings of keffiyehs and other than raising the issues of the kidnapped and the abducted by ICE on the grounds, on the specious, entirely fallacious grounds of anti-Semitism, other than that, you would really not have known that Gaza existed at all. Now let's take a step back, Chuck, and do one of those, what do you call those things where you do like the wide angle lens view, the big view, the, you know what I'm talking about. The camera's back and we're looking at a big view. What does it say about the left in the United States and our ability to rise to the level of this moment? That you have 50,000 people protesting the Trump administration on everything but this genocide in Gaza that they're now using as a pretext to destroy our civil liberties at home, and a 15-minute walk away, another 8,000 people talking about Gaza. How are these demonstrations not one demonstration? How, if you're saying hands off about every issue under the sun, you know, science, you know, the NIH, you know, the Kennedy Center, all these issues, hands off, and yet you're not going to say hands off of Gaza? I mean, the very existence, I mean, this is what I'm saying, like two marches apart. And then the last thing I'll just say is that I can't say, Chuck, that I have some view of the whole country, but you know, like say a place like Chicago, for example, where I knew people at the demo, it was all one march. The Gaza people, the hands off people, you know, you had one march. This is our anti-Trump march, you know? And I don't know if that's because of our proximity to power, our proximity to Capitol Hill. And then what does that say? That Capitol Hill is now putting up a restriction. They're putting up an electrical fence. That, yeah, we can protest Trump, but we can't talk about Gaza, which reflects what you were talking about with Cory Booker, about, oh my God, you can speak for 167 hours against Trump, but you can't say the word Gaza. I mean, to me, it speaks to a moral sickness in our politics, particularly locally, and frankly, particularly with the Capitol Hill Democrats, who I would argue, I didn't think this at the start of Trump's term, Chuck, I'll be frank with you about that. But I would argue that if you're not talking about Gaza, it is impossible to build a resistance to Trump. An effect.
100% agreed. You know, the hands-off flyer had 22 items listed, and then it said in more. And not one of those 22 was Gaza. Similar to the Cory Booker going 25 hours. How can Gaza not make your 25-hour fascism list? I don't know, maybe you didn't have to go to the bathroom. Was it going to come in the 26th hour? How can your Gaza not make your top 22 list when it should be number one? And when I say it should be number one, I don't just mean morally. I just don't mean ethically, because we understand that genocide is the highest form of evil. It doesn't get worse. I was raised as a Jew. I'm the number 6 million. Like, you go to any Jew, 6 million, they know what that means. So we know it's the highest form of evil. We know if the Palestinians were Jewish, it would be number one on that list. So we have to call it out. And we've been calling it out for moral reasons, for consistent reasons, for anti-fascist reasons. But I think you also have to call it out for pragmatic reasons, for people who don't get it. Even if genocide doesn't move you, you're so Americanized that you don't care about somebody in the other 96% of the population that is not America, you have to know, or you should know, that the future of Gaza as a laboratory is the future of America. You have to know that if you're going to have a discussion on free speech in America, that starts with Gaza and all the laws that they are changing about speech and anti-Semitism awareness acts that are in Congress right now, and universities that are changing to an IHRA definition that will make critiquing Israel a hate speech? Well, if you make critiquing Israel a hate speech, what do you think's next? Critiquing America. If you're talking about what's going on in Gaza right now, and we know every single police chief across the country is going to Gaza and using the same surveillance, using weapons, using technology, using the intelligence to do to American citizens, particularly in black and brown communities, if you're not making that connection, you can't fight that at home. So the idea that Gaza is something that is global and not domestic against and is the root and the laboratory of many of the issues that the hands-off people are fighting shows that you have a lack of political analysis, and you're never going to get what you want until you open your eyes, until you understand the global international structure of the fascism that is happening in the country. So it's not just immoral, it's stupid from a pragmatic point of view.
Yeah, and I'm going to take it. I agree with you, Chuck, and I'm going to take it another step. I think one of the reasons why you don't have it at something like the Hands Off March is that we have to, is that the Democratic Party, they want to build right now an electoral front against what Trump is doing. They are trying to figure out how to do it. Every day there's a new battle plan. You got Cory Booker talking for 24 hours. You've got all of these different facets of the party trying to talk to themselves. What do we do? What do we do? What do we do? And what they don't want to face, what they cannot face, is that Trump is only able to do what he's been able to do because of what Democratic mayors and a Democratic administration did to college students over the previous year.
That's exactly right.
Robbing them of their free speech, robbing them of their freedom of assembly, insisting that they get in trouble. Do we have such a short memory that we forget the pillorying of college presidents that happened? That was under the Biden administration, that they were dragged in front of Congress. Now, you could say, well, Republicans dragged them, but no, that was bipartisan.
That was bipartisan.
They were attacked by Elise Stefanik the way they were. And, you know, frankly, some of them deserve to be attacked for what they did do to protesters. And they're attacking them for what they didn't do to protesters.
Yes.
And that laid the groundwork for all of this. And so for the Democratic Party to raise an effective resistance, there would have to be them taking accountability for how they rolled out the red carpet for this current abridgment of civil liberties. And that is something they're not willing to do. And that leads to a different discussion. Like, why can't they just say, like, hey, this fight against anti-Semitism is an utter sham? Well, it's a little tough to say that when your Senate majority leader Chuck Schumer, is rolling out a book that says, oh, the fight against anti-Semitism is on our campuses and it must be waged. Gee, good timing for that book, Chuck. Great timing. And you see what I'm saying? It's like you can't build an effective resistance unless you're willing to say that the attacks on college students was not only immoral, but it actually laid the groundwork for where we are now. And the operational conclusion of that is we must defend Mahmoud Khalil. We must defend everybody who's been abducted. We must defend Rumeysa. And we must defend the right of college students to continue, whether they're international students or not. We must defend their right to continue to protest because the genocide is ongoing.
That is very well said. I mean, you nailed that, DZ. That's exactly right. And, you know, when you're telling me that we used the word desperate earlier, we've used that word a lot. You have a desperate Democratic Party with nowhere to go. The people are outraged, but they don't know where to go. They hear anyone give them a bone and they're like, okay, because I'm not hearing Schumer saying nothing. I'm not hearing King Jeffries saying, I'm not hearing any leadership match my outrage. So the first person who sounds like they're outraged, they're following. When in reality, you should look at their positions, because we were protesting Jamie Raskin, okay? That's not somebody who's going to lead anyone. And what the Democratic Party and people who follow have to do is give up this idea that they're going to save you. It's time to let go. You have to go with people. There are unions who are fighting. There are people in the streets who are fighting. There are people who are using other tools and boycotts. There are people who are thinking about third parties. They're thinking of people who are fighting locally, politically. They're doing all of those things. How many times are you going to follow a false prophet who's just rebranding fascism in a little bit of a different way? Either you are anti-fascist or you are not. Either you're fascist or you're not. If you're going to fight Trump's fascism, you can't do it with fascism. You can't move genocide out of the way. And what I'm going to say, and this is not something in it, that's my opinion. I am saying a fact. I'm going to state a fact for anyone who doesn't know how massive, how sustained these Free Gaza protests are, how the conviction of the people fighting it, who are looking at images of babies being burned in their cell phones every day. I am telling people, unaware, because there's a media blackout, it is not going away. You can't sidestep it. If you want to lose, if Democrats want to lose every single election, then they keep down that path and ignoring what's happening. Mm-hmm. But if someone who wants to really fight fascism, then you need to put forward anti-fascist candidates, both domestically, both globally. And if you can't do that, people are going to flock to another party. They're going to flock to other spaces. And I am informing people. I am not debating anyone on this point, because you don't know what's going on in the street and you're not in touch with pundits on TV. That's not our problem. But the Democrats are not going to save anyone, because they've shown who they are, especially since Trump has been elected.
Yeah, and we got to go to break right now. I'm thrilled that we're going to have Etan Thomas joining us on the other side of this break. I'll just say one last word about that, Chuck, is that everything we're talking about, A, connects with what happened with Luka Doncic last night in his return to Dallas. Believe it or not, that connection is going to be made. And B, I am at a point where I'm not going to hear from anybody from the Democratic Party about building a resistance if they're taking AIPAC money. Because AIPAC, I believe, I'm going to make this argument here. I've never been team AIPAC. You know that, Chuck. You know me well. I would also argue that over the last decade, they have shifted themselves from being a kind of, oh, we just want to give money to everybody who wants to support Israel. But because Israeli society has moved so far to the right in terms of its formal politics, that now means that AIPAC is like, yeah, if you're going to take our money, you have to vote for fascist things. You have to support fascist things. And the Democratic Party as a whole has followed them down this path. And now they're at the point telling us, oh, well, you can't be for, you know, fascism. We have to stand up. And it's like, look whose money you are taking. You are giving the game away, and that's just unacceptable. So if you're taking AIPAC money and I'm talking to you, you're going to hear about it from me. So, yo, let's go to a break right now, and we come back on the other side. We're going to connect this discussion, and we're going to connect it first and foremost by speaking to 10-year NBA vet, Collision co-host, and man about town, Etan Thomas. He's joining us. We'll be back right after this on The Collision. Back here on The Collision, where sports and politics collide. That was, of course, KRS-One. Can we hear the name of the track, please?
Out of Here.
Never mentioned when people talk about the great MCs, when people do the 50-year overview of great MCs. I am never hearing KRS-One's name, and I, for the life of me, do not understand why. Obviously, he's on the top of my list. I think Magic Mike has him near the top of his as well.
Oh, he's at the tippy top.
Yeah, not that I want to speak for you, Mike. But
I mean,
there's two
number ones, but you can't have that. But I would take Chris simply because of his catalog over Rakim.
Yeah, but that's the thing. Like Eminem did his like top 20, and each of the 20 are unassailable. They're all great choices, but then you're like, wait, Chris isn't even there? It's like
I
that's
know,
the
it's
stuff
weird.
that I don't even understand. But hey, I'm not here to speak for Eminem. I'm here to speak for the Collision, where sports and politics collide. 89.3 FM WPFW. So happy to have with Chuck Modiano and me, Etan Thomas. Etan, how you doing, sir?
I'm doing pretty good, fellas. How y'all doing?
Good. I'm gonna throw it right in your
Great.
lap. Oh, yeah, I'm gonna throw it right in your lap, Etan, because we saved the topic for you. Last night, back in Dallas, Luka Doncic with the Lakers. Tears are flowing before the game from Luka in a one of the most genuine displays of emotions I've frankly ever seen from a player at an NBA game, just sobbing on the sideline. He steps out there. Despite all the emotion, he somehow holds it together, drops 45 points in the game. The crowd is loving him, time to the nth degree. Fire Nico chants aimed at Nico Harrison, the GM who made the deal that shocked the world. Etan Thomas, give us your helicopter view of everything that happened and any political conclusions you might draw.
Oh, well, I mean, first of all, it was an amazing game. It was great to see Luka go in there. You know, the emotions, like you said, were kind of overflowing. You know, but I saw you mentioned the Fire Nico chants, and I quoted you this morning. I saw your post. I was like, oh, that's fantastic. I don't see anybody else making this point except for our very own Dave Zirin. So this was the point that you made. You said, and I'm quoting you. He said to score 45 points in that atmosphere was an all-time answering of the bell. It's why you don't trade 25-year-old generational talents to your rival. But is the right chant Fire Nico or expropriate Miriam? Or would the irony of Miriam Adelson having her property seized be a little too much of a Hollywood ending? Now, I thought that was great. And so I had to add to it and point out the fact that Miriam is the governor of the Dallas Mavericks right now. It's no longer Mark Cuban. She is the governor. She owns the Dallas Mavericks, right? But the GM, who is Nico Harrison, is the one who is getting all the blame for the Luka trade. Like the Fire Nico chants there, you know, they have the Fire Nico shirts, they have the posters, they have all over the place. It's all Nico, 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 right? So and it's like they're acting like Nico Harrison, who is the GM, made a unilateral decision to trade Luka, and that's just not the way it works. And you are the first person that I have seen to point that out. So I had to quote you, and I posted a little meme about it. It's getting a lot of responses, a lot of people saying, yes, finally, somebody said it. Why is it all Nico? Like, I mean, he's part of the blame, but he's not the sole person to blame. Nothing goes without the top person. And that top person is Miriam Allison.
Yes, well put. And of course, the connective tissue to the first part of this discussion is that Miriam Adelson is the number one Trump donor in the United States, the number one. And Miriam Adelson is also somebody who constantly is buying up land in the West Bank. Land. She's already put money down to be able to take land in Gaza for when that's expropriated from the Palestinian people. She is a supporter openly of annexing the West Bank and Gaza. And she, when Trump talks about building casinos in Gaza, that's really who he's talking about. I mean, she is the big casino builder, one of the richest people in the world. This is what she does. And she is all about Israel from the river to the sea, which is why I made that comment about, like, if she approved this trade of Luka, and of course she did, maybe she should have her property seized. See how she feels about it. Because that's who is really at fault here, not Nico Harrison. And all I can say is, his willingness to be the tip of the spear, his or his willingness to be, the shield for the decisions made by the Adelson family. I mean, all I gotta say is I hope it pays well, and it couldn't be me, because what you saw last night was frankly the fruits of a person in Miriam Adelson who it's less that she doesn't know what she's doing and more that she really just doesn't care. She doesn't care about Dallas. She doesn't care about the people in Dallas. You know, I'm convinced there's something nefarious going on with her trying to pressure the Dallas politicians to have them build her a casino for a new arena. And this is her way of saying, if you don't get it, I'll move the team to Vegas where I own every politician. And that could happen overnight. I know people tell me I'm conspiratorial and I'm out of my mind for saying this, but there it is for me. You know, to me, it's all tied up in who Miriam Adelson is and what I would describe as the most shocking, I'm not going to call it the worst because I got too much respect for Anthony Davis, but the most shocking trade in NBA history.
Very well said. No, very well said. And a lot of people don't know who Miriam Adelson is. And she's been relatively, I don't know if in the background purposely, I saw some comments saying, yeah, people in Dallas know, you know, and some of the local, I guess, coverage has been including Adelson with some of the Fire Nico rage. But really, on a broader scale, you know, national media, I haven't really heard her name being mentioned at all. You know what I mean? All the mainstream networks, whether it's ESPN, FS1, that I've heard a lot of Nico, but haven't heard anything about her. So it's important that people, you know, really know her background. And I suspect that you're going to write an article sometime soon making all the connections with her background, especially to Gaza. I suspect, I could be wrong, but I suspect that might be what we see soon from Desire.
Well, yeah, I mean, it definitely, it's going to be something that I got to write about. I wrote about it before when the trade happened, but I think last night provides another opportunity to put those ideas out there because they're important ideas. It's important that people see how these connections exist. And the other thing, I'll tell you this, Etan and Chuck, is since I wrote that initial article, and I'm not saying in any way, shape, or form this is because of me, but the idea this is some kind of conspiracy, Miriam Adelson moving the team to Vegas, you know, free money for a casino basketball arena combo. That's become a big enough question as people try to explain the unexplainable trade that it's regularly discussed in the Dallas media now, the mainstream media. Like, is this an Adelson trick? By trading Luka, is she trying to demoralize the fan base so she can move the team? And of course they deny it, and you know, the people all say, oh, it's ridiculous, but it just says a great deal to me that it even has to be answered. Something that was, when it originally got raised, was seen as just conspiratorial nonsense.
It can't be conspiratorial nonsense because you cannot trade Luka without getting owner approval. I believe, you know, it's just as likely. Yeah, Nico took an order and to be a scapegoat. I mean, I think I've heard, you know, we could verify this, but when Sheldon Adelson, before he died, the Adelsons have given Trump something like $337 million. I've heard that. That's the highest figure over the years. And, you know, and part of that is when Trump, he took a big donation. I mean, huge. These are not little donations. I just said $337 million. And the part is when he moved the capital to Jerusalem.
Yeah, the embassy.
After the embassy, thank you. The embassy to Jerusalem. That came after one of those donations because at the time there was some thought that Trump is so wild and independent and could do anything that maybe he may have a different approach on Israel, but the money that he received is unprecedented. Even, you know, if you take the Apex and the Kufis and all of that, we haven't seen money at this level. And Trump has been doing the Adelsons bidding in very outlandish ways. I think it would be incredibly foolish to not say yes. There is absolutely something going on here. And yes, there is a connection to the Luka trade, because if we're sitting here thinking Nico Harrison has that kind of power, then you need to show me through the entire history of the NBA another GM who's had that kind of power to do a secret deal, not look for any other offers that are better, and not get owner approval. Please, there's no historical evidence of that ever happening. So let's open our eyes, and I appreciate you putting that, you and Tom putting that out there.
No doubt. And I have a question for Tom, but first, Chuck, you just jogged my memory about something. Probably one of the most powerful GMs in NBA history was Jerry West. Jerry West in 1979, of course, famously drafted 19-year-old Magic Johnson number one. I spoke to somebody who, a confidant of Jerry West, who told me that Jerry West, you know, was kind of really getting interested in that draft with another guard. Believe it or not, not taking Magic. That's correct, Sidney Moncrief. Very good.
Bam! And can I get some applause on that one? Can I?
Pretty good, Chuck.
That was impressive, Chuck.
All right,
that was
okay. Impressive. I need my ego stroked on that one. Go ahead. Continue.
And you know what? I have to say, if his career wasn't so horribly cut short by injuries, people might not even see that as that crazy. Sidney Moncrief was a special dude. He was
special, yeah.
You know, and we don't talk about him ever because of injuries, but come on, and magic is magic. Yeah. But you know, Sidney Moncrief was special. As soon as Jerry West's nose turned towards Sidney Moncrief, Jerry Buss was like, turn that nose back right now. Because Magic Johnson is generational, and we're not going to stray from the script. So that's even Jerry West, when it comes to a generational player, was told to mind his P's and Q's. So that says something to me. So
that's a great point.
Yeah. So that being said, Etan, based on what you've seen last night, let's get a little basketball-y right here. Do you think the Lakers legitimate threat coming out of the West, or is this just OKC and the gang? Or do you think Golden State maybe has an edge over the Lakers right now? Who is making your nostrils flare a little bit when it comes to the Western Conference?
Well, Oklahoma City Thunder are really exciting to watch. And, you know, I definitely wouldn't count them out. Golden State, I mean, the way that Steph Curry plays sometimes is interesting. People were wondering how it was going to work out with Jimmy Butler. And I think it's been working out pretty great. So they would definitely have to be up there as well. We saw how Houston played Steph Curry and shadowed him in a way that I haven't really seen in the NBA. I can't say that I have. I've seen it at a, you know, younger level, but they literally had somebody sandwiching him everywhere he went. Like, he could not move. And it was right after the game where he scored 52. So I don't know if you're going to see people copycat that and make somebody else have to beat them, but I thought that was pretty interesting. But yeah, those are the top teams. You know, then you have the Lakers. So I don't know who I would take. It'd be some great basketball when they meet up in the playoffs. But out of those top three, I don't know. It could kind of go either way. Like, what do y'all think? I couldn't pick just one. I think there would be fantastic games either way.
Well, it does raise another team, though, right away. Because this year, we're going to have a player who finishes in the top three of points, rebounds, and assists. For the first time in NBA history that someone's ever done that. And, of course, I'm talking about Nikola Jokic. He gets his coach fired. No, he doesn't get his coach fired. I said that wrong. The coach gets fired, Mike Malone, 2 years off of winning a championship, 9 days before the start of the playoffs. Etan,
horrible.
Is this something in a million years that you saw coming? And what do you think? Like, how does a play – I mean, is that – does the message, is that sent to the player? Like, why? Why? I mean, it's like you're throwing the towel in on the seat. I mean, just correct me if I'm wrong. What kind of message would that send to a locker room?
I mean, that the team is in disarray. I mean, I posed the question. I said, does this happen without the approval of Jokic? You know, does this happen? And then I said that if say the Lakers, just hypothetically, you know, say the Lakers right before the playoffs fired their head coach and their GM. Who would be the one who got all the blame? Who would all the talking heads be talking
LeBron,
about?
LeBron, of course. It would be LeBron.
It'd be LeBron, yes. But
I thank you a ton because I hadn't thought about that, but continue.
I mean, and I'm not saying anything negative about Jokic. I'm just saying that that's the way it's interesting how the media decides who they want to blame for what. You know what I mean? And it doesn't matter what the truth is, doesn't matter what reality is. You know, it depends. But I haven't, and I was listening. I was like, okay, let me see if somebody's. Of course, they talked to Jokic about this. He's a franchise player. Of course, he had to give his sign off on it. Of course, 100%. I saw that happen myself while I was in the league. Before major moves are made, they talk to the franchise player. That's usually what happens. But it's just so interesting. You didn't hear that conversation at all. Sorry to go off on that tangent. That wasn't your question, but
it's not a tangent. That's an important point.
Yeah. I thought that was interesting.
It is interesting. I think Jokic gives off this vibe of being like a step removed. I guess what's the proof of that, Atan, going to be is, you know, Jokic as famously loyal to the Nuggets. Mike Malone is the only coach he's ever had, which is wild if you think about that. So what's going to happen in the offseason? You're either going to see Jokic settle in with a new coach that he approves of, or you're going to really start hearing trade rumblings. I mean, these betting sites are already taking odds as to what will the next team be that Jokic plays for. And all I got to say is that if he ends up as the new center for the centerless Los Angeles Lakers, I might have to just be like coach and watch college ball from now on.
That's a wishful thinking. I don't know. I mean, there hasn't been any kind of hints that he's unhappy there, right? It's just kind of people, I don't know. I have seen that, but I think that's people just kind of speculating, putting the Lakers in everything. I don't know. I don't see that happening myself.
It's a weird way is that we're complimenting LeBron right now, because if there was this kind of move in LA, LeBron would be in front of the cameras speaking about it. And almost like a political figure, like, oh, this needs to be discussed, you know, let's have a press conference. while you know, Jokic is just like, I just want to get through the playoffs and get back to my horses in Serbia. And, you know, this has been, you know, all this stuff. So it's going to be the proof of the pudding is going to be Jokic's pose in the offseason. I expect him to keep it on the hush hush until this season ends. But my goodness, what a season this man is having. But also a shout out to Giannis Antetokounmpo with a 35 points, 20 assists, 17 rebound game.
Amazing. Ooh. Amazing.
What kind of player is this?
What is going on?
And that no one's talking about him for MVP.
This is absolutely amazing.
not even in the MVP discussion.
Right.
Which is wild enough.
I want to ask y'all this. I know, Chuck, you were talking about this too. Did you see the disrespect of Hakeem Olajuwon? That's all. Did y'all see it?
Oh, my.
Go ahead.
I'll go ahead. I cannot believe when I saw that security guard not allow Hakeem in. That's royalty right there. That's two championships, not just with the Rockets, but back-to-back Final Fours with the Houston Cougars. And somebody else was trying to talk to him to say, let him in. That's the dream right there. And he still wouldn't. And what that tells me is one of two things. If you don't know, I mean, if you know it's the dream and you don't let him in, you should be fired for bad judgment. And if you don't know it's the dream, you never should have been hired to work a Final Four in the first place. Maybe go work at NASCAR or something, a NASCAR event, because I'm pretty sure, and I'm speculating right now, that if Jeff Gordon was trying to say, hey, let me go celebrate with my homies over there, that he might have been like, yes, Mr. Gordon, let me part a path for you so you can go do that and maybe take some selfies on the way. That is ridiculous. And I'm going to be honest, you know, If it was a black security guard, I'm pretty sure they'd have known it was a team and everything would have been fine. So, you know, maybe we got a white DEI hire going on there that ruined the whole thing.
A very, very, very wise point, to be sure. I mean, disrespecting Hakeem in anything related to Houston basketball, college or pro, is actually, to me, a desecration of the game itself. That's how strongly I feel about that.
Agreed.
Very upsetting.
Hurt to watch.
hard to watch. And before we go, I know I just want to give a shout out to the coach I really wish had won the NCAA men's championship, Kelvin Sampson with Houston. It was there for him the whole game. Devastating ending, Etan. Etan, you know, this was a little bit before my time, but a dear friend of mine with Georgetown connection said, that reminds me of the time when it was John Thompson in Georgetown against Dean Smith's UNC Tar Heels, and Fred Brown threw the ball to James Worthy on the last play.
Yep, that is true, but props to them for beating Duke.
All right, we'll give them love for that.
Hey, props to them for that.
That's right.
And props to Kelvin Sampson for always being so proud of being with the of the Lumbee Native American people of North Carolina. And his father, Ned Sampson, who was part of an event they still celebrate in their small town in North Carolina of when they routed the Ku Klux Klan in 1958 and ran them out of town. It's called, I forget what it's called. It's called the Battle of a Particular River. It was the Lumbee. I mean, just an amazing hidden part of U.S. history that Kelvin Sampson is very, very personally tied to. So love to Kelvin Sampson for always representing his Lumbee heritage. Love that. The Battle of Hayes Pond, that's what it's called, and it's celebrated every single year in this part of North Carolina. The routing of
I've been there, by the way. I've been down to Lumbee, and I've worked with some youth centers down there. Yep.
Wow, Chuck, that sounds like a good show. Yeah. Well, we've reached the end of our time this week. Etan Thomas, thank you for joining us at the end here. Any last words, sir?
No problem. I'll be headed out to Philly for Maryland Juniors volleyball. My baby girl, baby Sierra, is going to be playing. So shout out to them, and it's going down.
Let's go.
Wow.
Let's go.
Shout out right there. Chuck, any last words for you?
Let's go. Let's go, all of Etan's family. That's everybody is killing it in every sport, it seems.
That's right.
Yeah, that's what I'm hearing.
The intellectual / athletic dynasty of the Thomas family. Oh, we gotta go. Yo, for everybody out there listening, please stay frosty. We are out here on the Collision. Peace. Who can keep the average dancer hyper as a
يتمتع جميع الأشخاص في الولايات المتحدة بحقوق بغض النظر عن وضعهم في الهجرة. معرفة حقوقنا هي الخطوة الأولى للحفاظ على سلامنا ضد انتهاكات إدارة الهجرة والجمارك الأمريكية التي تسمى ICE أو غيرها من هيئات إنفاذ القانون لحقوقنا كمواطنين ومهاجرين. فهنا نقدم دليل لحماية حقوقكم. أولاً، تحديد جهات الاتصال في حالات الطوارئ وحفظ أرقامها. ثانياً، حافظ على هدوئك إذا اقترب منك أو منك مكتب الهجرة والجمارك أو أي جهة إنفاذ القانون أخرى. لا ترقد أو تجادل أو تقاوم أو تقاتل. ثالثاً، لديك الحق في التزام الصمت. رابعاً، لديك الحق في التحدث إلى محامي وعدم التوقيع على أي شيء حتى تناقشه مع المحامي. خامساً، إذا كنت في المنزل، لديك الحق في رفض الدخول ما لم يتم تقديم أي أمر قضائي موقع من قاضي. فيجب أن يكون الأمر هو موقع من قاضي وليس ابن آيس. لا يسمح أمر آيس بالدخول في منزلك. سادسا، لديك الحق في الحصول على مترجم. وأخيرا، نحن مع WPFW دائما ندافع عن الحقوق الإنسان التي تم اكتسابها بشق الأنفس، بناء عالم أكثر عدالة من خلال بث واحد بعد الآخر. وشكرا.
WPFW presents Still We Rise, our 48th anniversary celebration. on Friday, April 25th from 7 until 11 p.m. at Martin's Crosswinds in Greenbelt, Maryland. Entertainment will be provided by vocalist Navasha Dea and her trio, and WPFW programmers and poets Esther Everam and Zain El Amin. The evening includes an award ceremony, dinner, and dancing to the music of DJ James Funk. That's Still We Rise, WPFW's 48th anniversary celebration. Details at WPFWFM.org.
WPFW swag in your life? Idols that say, I support jazz and justice without saying a word.